Podcasting from their studio in London. Get ready for an interesting adventure. AOK the podcast sets to take you on a thought-provoking journey. Now here's your host, the Oracle on the topic of kindness, Josie Perez.
Hello, beautiful listeners. This is Josie Perez, and welcome to an exciting special edition of AOK the podcast. It's Pride Month, everybody. And today I'm joined by an amazing rainbow warrior all the way from South Africa. So we are here today to talk about the amplifying of African queer voices across the world, where we see underrepresentation in mainstream media. I feel motivated to ensure that these voices are heard and represented by the people, for the people. So I'm really, really excited to be joined today by Steve, all the way from South Africa, the Executive Director for Access Chapter 2. So without further ado, yeah. Steve, welcome. Would you like to just give us a bit of an introduction of who you are and the sort of work that you've been up to, mainly within South Africa and Commonwealth?
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you so much, Josie. And really, I'm excited to be part of this podcast. And I really appreciate the invitation to join this conversation.
No, I feel honored. Again,
yeah. And again, my name, as you introduced, is Steve Litsike. I am the executive director and founder of Access Chapter 2. Mm-hmm. Which is a human rights organization focusing on LGBTI persons, women and girls. And of course, myself as a lesbian and as a feminist, it was necessary to, really establish an organization, and also as a Black lesbian woman, yeah. In South Africa to really, fight for the rights that are enshrined in the Constitution. So in fact, Chapter 2, which is the Bill of Rights in our Constitution. So that's why the sentiments of Access Chapter 2 is to make the rights, to a lived reality. I'm also the co-chair of the Commonwealth Equality Network, which is the network that advocates and fight for the rights of LGBTI people within the Commonwealth member states. As you know, Commonwealth, which is carries a whole history of colonization platform. But anyhow, it brings together all countries that was colonized by the British government. It's about 54 countries. Mm-hmm. So we have membership in all these countries as a network. So we utilize the platform of the heads of government of Commonwealth to advocate for the rights and decriminalization of LGBTI or same sex in these countries.
Yeah.
But back home here in South Africa, I also co-chair the national task team that addresses hate crimes. This is a body or structure established by the Department of Justice. So all the hate incidents that are occurring across the country, and it's such a difficult time that you and I are also having this conversation, because we've seen a rise in the last 10 weeks. Over 10 LGBTI people have been brutally murdered, but also that we've seen a rise on physical and sexual attacks.
Wow.
So this body is responding to the hate crime incidents. And the last structure, which I think it's relevant to note here, is the responsibility I have together with the Deputy President of the Republic, which is to co-chair the National AIDS Council.
Mm-hmm.
That brings together government and civil society and private sector to respond to the HIV, T TB and STI. You know, South Africa also, again, is the epicenter of the HIV globally. We have over 7.9 million people living with HIV.
Which is starking, isn't it? Very starking. Yeah, I think people forget that, you know, HIV hasn't gone away. It's still here.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. During COVID, you can't even shift, to not address the big pandemics that we suffer here in South Africa. That includes HIV and gender-based violence. So, so it's quite necessary to keep these agendas on the table. So yeah, I'm from South Africa. I'm based in Pretoria, I've been working in the sector for the last 17 years. It's really a long time. So I'm also, putting succession plan to allow young people to be coming on board and to lead us, so already, which is quite an important thing for me, of why we need to ensure youth, you know, come in place and also help us navigate these challenges that we've been battling with around social justice.
That's amazing. I mean, what a resume. That's one of the reasons, like I said before we started recording, was my main motivation was really, we don't hear about these things, the gender-based violence of what you're talking about. You know, the mainstream media never really reports that much on Africa until things are like at the worst part of when things are happening. So it's really good to hear right from the horse's mouth, so to speak, about what's actually happening on the ground, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to not only celebrate, but also talk about these issues happening during Pride Month, because, you know, we could do this podcast at any other month because we shouldn't just leave it, during Pride Month. But I thought this will help amplify and put things like this in the spotlight. Yeah. So you were talking about the sort of what's happening in terms of violence and stuff. Is this particularly with LGBT plus people? Is there statistics or figures that have gone out in terms of what's happening there?
Yeah, look, no doubt South Africa is, when the president declared 2 years ago that South Africa has a pandemic of gender-based violence, we knew that because of the attacks on women and children, the attacks on LGBTI persons generally, that's what we've been struggling with. But I think where a consistent weekly a murder and brutal murder of LGBTI person, it's also a rise that we've seen over the last 10 weeks, that, you know, we are now counting bodies of LGBTI persons who are brutally murdered. So the 10 people, or actually it's over now, it's about 12 people now, that have been reported to be, murdered and brutally so, because these are just not your ordinary murder of, somebody, who has just been one stepped and left there, there's brutality to it, there's suffering to it. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of bodies we are counting on a weekly basis. And the fact that, many of these cases, the suspects are now also being arrested and there's confession to it, so I think it really gives us a big concern of it's taking us back to, the suffering that we've seen in 2012 and again in 2007, when there was this rise of hate crime attacks. These are intentional acts. It's message crimes, as we know, as definition of a hate crime is a bias act. Yeah. So it's happening to identified people, identified group, and it's sending a message to all of us that even those of us in, who are active and who are working in the sector, every LGBTI person is now scared to be themselves, is scared to walk in the street because it's a question of, am I next?
Yeah. Wow. That's really, really scary and eye-opening. Do you know what's fueling this? What's sitting behind, you know, is it because at the moment the spotlight is on it, or do you think this has been going on all along? It's just the pandemic is kind of like highlighting the current issue.
Look, this has been going on for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the violence and the hate is systematically maintained by social realities and religious fundamentalism and so forth. It has been going on. So it's really highlighted because of many inequalities that exist.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also highlighted because of the hate that exists. One cannot walk away from the attitude and behavior of society towards LGBTI people. It seems like now people have even much more confidence to act it out.
Wow.
To act out the hate. And people have no conscience whatsoever of respecting human dignity and integrity, of respecting human rights and respecting the rule of law. Because clearly the significance of how government enforces or law enforces really would be enforcing the rule of law and justice coming in. So people know that they are more likely to get away with murder, and that's the biggest issue. But also people do not just care. And that's practically why we see this rise happening. I think so many things are at play. As I've said, one needs to look at the role of different societal institutions mm-hmm. that have contributed to so much hate. And these societal institutions that one way or the other, are not necessarily prepared to really, be of justice champions of changing the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
You do have allies within the religious sectors. You do have allies within the cultural sector. But it's just a small fraction that doesn't have a huge impact. We do need many more of the religious leaders and cultural leaders or traditional leaders to come out very strong and not mix the world if they care about human dignity and if they care about human beings. So I think it's some of these frank conversations that we still need to be having continuously to change that narrative.
I totally agree. I mean, there's so much that religious leaders have to answer for, if I'm honest. It's not just in South Africa, but all over the world. That's we know correct. Conversion therapy is a massive issue in the Western world. I know it, even within South Africa, most likely as well. America still has so many states where it's completely legal. In the UK, for example, they are still in discussion about making it illegal. It shouldn't even be an option. It should just be that it's not a legal process to try to convert someone from. I know that I'm an out LGBT plus person, and I feel that I was born this way. I can't understand why leaders or, religious leaders or spiritual leaders have not taken a stand and call this sort of brutality and behavior wrong. I don't know if you've heard of the film 1946, the movie, the mistranslation that's shifted culture. It's actually in the process of being made at the moment, and I'm good friends with the director on there, and they are calling out the mistranslation in the Bible, backed by academic evidence that homosexuality was never in the Bible pre-1946. So I am hoping that this is going to be a huge eye-opening thing around the world, because it's going to change so many people's lives, be it in South Africa or America or the UK or whatever, you know, there will be a lot of backlash. Obviously, there already is a lot of hate going towards this documentary being made. But hopefully when it's released in the next year, you know, it's going to really, really amplify, you know, the truth behind so many things that has happened as a result in the name of religion, if you want to call it that.
But no, absolutely. I mean, you're quite correct. We have been implementing a project that challenges conversion practices in South Africa. And for us was to really go beyond, you know, the how it's defined globally. Because the possibility of limitations of how global overview of conversion therapy would be limiting for us. I mean, you would have heard, and I mean, as an African or having your African roots come from here, you would understand how LGBTI constantly, everywhere across the region, are reminded that they are not African if they are lesbian or gay or trans, or even bi for that matter. So there's quite a bit of doctrine beyond religion, beyond medical, a view of conversion practice, but also looking at the cultural component that is also at play. So we have been working together with Outright International around this campaign work. Working also with other partners in the region, and you know, so we have three partners that we work with in Nigeria, in Kenya, and also us in South Africa. Of course, our campaign, which is called Inxebalam, it's a Xhosa word, Xhosa word that says, my wound. Or you know, and it's quite important for us to narrate this in our native language, because it's representing exactly the kind of wound that is inflicted in LGBTI lives. Every person, every LGBTI person in this region walks around with a wound, because this wound was created by the very same conversion acts and practices, whether culturally, religiously, or even from a psychosocial point of view, and by the medical practitioners, you know, whether you're talking about a psychologist or psychiatrist for that matter. But also, I mean, this is it's ways that finds us in our families, in our communities, in the entire society, and even by the states themselves. I mean, what is at play, you know, by state homophobic laws and so forth. So these are wounds. Everybody of us walk around with these wounds, one or the other, or multiple forms of wounds that are inflicted. But they're also one of the thing about our campaign on, you know, which addresses conversion practices, was what, you know, the wound will have to be looked at in two forms. One is what is inflicted, but also how this wound makes me stronger, because wounds have a potential of healing. You may remain with a scar, you know. Some LGBTI person overcome these challenges and they walk around with a scar, you know, that was that had a very severe wound, but they are stronger and they still demonstrate that element of pride and existence, and they resist
absolutely
in many ways.
Warriors.
And you have others who aren't able to overcome it, and they find themselves challenged again with you know, social ills, and they, you know, end up being challenged by, you know, substance use and abuse. Some commit suicide and so forth. I mean, just about 3 weeks ago, we had a lesbian woman who committed suicide, and in her note, and she left it to her family to saying that I can't do this anymore. All you have done was to fight me for being lesbian. And you always insisted that I be married to a man, you know, and it, it's impossible that I would be married to a man. So I'd rather help you and help myself take this life away. In this way, you will not be able to dictate on it anymore. So I think it's such a triggering letter, to demonstrate the existence and the challenges that many go through. It goes through because of cultural practices of arranged marriages. How many people have been told that you have to have a child, you have to be married to opposite sex and so forth. It happens in our Black community. And these are stories that we deal with as Access Chapter 2 on a daily basis. And you would understand that as organizations, we rely on funding, on resources to continue doing our work to help more than ourselves, as organized as we can be. And it becomes a challenge if, organizations are not sustained. And I think for us as Black communities, we really suffer multiple issues and we have our own to rely on.
Yes.
If we are not supported,
So can I ask, do you feel there is support from the government for the LGBT, these issues that you're mentioning? Do you feel that there is enough support coming from the government?
Look, I can tell you that our government can do better. It's a pity that they are not acting in a radical manner. To do better. Because right now we do not need only just words, we need action. We become disempowered, when there's little action. And government can't walk around demonstrating a sense of disempowerment for themselves. They are in the power position. So they have the obligation, they have the power to really change the narrative for LGBTI people. So there's very few allies within government that stand solidly wise to do better. But we just don't do or don't want just few steps. We want a kind of comprehensive approach. Mm-hmm. Of course, the president is one of the people who understand the architects of the Constitution, because he is himself was an architecture of the Constitution. He leads the executive, which is imbalanced in the views around LGBTI issues. And I think, as a leader, you're supposed to put your foot down and just do about a just approach to the work. So I mean, for the first time, our South African government commemorated Ida Hot. Mm-hmm. And you see across the country, various political leaders who stand up. I think the challenge becomes, it's not enough when the bureaucrats themselves are the ones who are actually homophobic and transphobic.
Absolutely.
And it becomes an imbalance act. And this is why you have quite a number of leaders who are misinformed, aligned in their work because of these very same bureaucrats who are homophobic and who are transphobic. So I think our country can do better. So that we know it's not enough. They can do better.
Absolutely. I think what sort of comes to mind for me is, solidarity in numbers. Not about saying, I think this is the argument that happens here where people go, oh, I'm sick of hearing about Black Lives Matter, or I'm sick of hearing stop pushing the gay agenda down our throats. And it's like, we're stronger if we come together. And we have solidarity because as quick as you're given your human rights and your rights per se, it can be stripped away from you. You know, we see things being under threat all the time, be it even in the UK, for example. We know that there's discussions going on in the background with the current government that we have, talking about LGBT plus rights, particularly trans rights. We know the trans community is massively under attack at the moment. So for me, I'm always, when I have discussions with people, I'm always talking about, it's not about who should be at the top of the pile. All rights should be protected. We should be advocating for all human rights, for all, whether it's LGBT, whether it's, you know, black and ethnic minorities, whether it's women's rights. If we're stronger together, we shouldn't like separate them. But when someone's having an issue right now, we should be there to support them. Because when the time comes and there's something happening at your house and your house is on fire, you know, you will hope that people will come there and help you and be there in solidarity to show you support, right? So, you know, that's always something that I'm like, from what you were saying there, you know, there's some people within the government who were showing support with Idea Hobbit Day. I think it's massively important that we have leaders, and we have, especially like with religious figures and stuff, calling out hate and bigotry. Because if you don't have that support, how are you meant to accomplish anything?
Absolutely.
You know, so yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying there. So just to talk a bit about you, Steve, what are your passions? What was your driving force to get you to where you are today and, you know, running with Access Chapter 2?
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, there's a bit of history, you know, just in my early teen years. You know, my activism started in the African National Congress movement, you know, and this is a political party. You know, I mean, you can just imagine transitioning from apartheid times. So the history of fighting, you know, for Black existence and Black rights and indigenous community, because we have a history as South Africa of prejudice where, you know, people were discriminated on the basis of the color of their skin because of apartheid government. Those who colonized South Africa took over. And you know, so that is a continuous systematic racism that, you know, even many of us who were born during that time, you know, we had to join in because this had to do with our lives as Black people. So for me, at the age of 13, being involved in a political party and organizing to challenge the systems, and also being born with very strong principles of challenging inequalities everywhere. So I think my passion came from that. It comes from where my deep roots of fighting for inequalities came on that. And also, I think, you know, this does not even take away that you're fighting multiple issues of being Black, being a woman, and being lesbian. And you know, where you are also pushed into a particular community. What apartheid government did, Black people were pushed out of cities or everywhere geographically, which creates economic hubs. So you are pushed into villages, you are pushed into townships. You know, in fact, the setup of township becomes out of economic hubs of city lives. So, which then means Black lives, issues of livelihood are also a big issue. Economic justice is a big issue. So hence you have multiple challenges of inequalities you're fighting. So for me, that passion was quite important. The education system was a bit of an issue because I was still in school. So you learning curriculums in a foreign language. We're still doing it with English not being our mother tongue, but it's worse that you had to even learn other subjects like mathematics or accounting in Afrikaans. So the education system was even a bit difficult because none of it was acknowledging of our own native languages.
Yeah.
We had English and Afrikaans as the first languages to converse or operate in. I am from Pretoria, so you can just imagine this is also where the hub of apartheid organizing was also is. You have Cape Town, you have Pretoria, you've got Free State,
yeah.
You know, where they organize very strongly in these different cities. But I think also one thing, was I had a family that taught me resistance and resilience.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was, involved in politics as well. In her young days, as much as we lost our parents at a very early age,
yeah.
I was only 7 years when she passed on.
Sorry to hear that.
And my other siblings, my younger brother was only 5 months.
Wow.
So you grow up with the history of what, your parents did. You also grow up with, a history of what your grandparents did. So there's that history that is rooted in you about resistance and resilience.
Absolutely.
And the needed to be a continuation, because it's not about the past, but it's about what exists now,
mm-hmm.
As part of our own realities. So you have to make a conscious choice about, do you live in society where it's still unequal, or you also are part of the solution? So for me, it was a solution oriented that I don't want to be a part of the problem, but to be a solution.
Absolutely.
And the fact that, I want to create a space where everybody can, find ways to enjoy their lives, enjoy their rights, but also have access at least to that very same dignity and integrity. I'm a family woman. I have a daughter,
yep.
And that's not the kind of life that I want for her.
Yeah.
So for me, it's basically that passion continues for that reason.
Which is absolutely amazing. I mean, it's about creating that legacy, isn't it? Creating a legacy that you feel proud of and that you know you've done your absolute best of what you're leaving behind for the next generation to make it easier for them. I suppose that's what we all do. That's what I do. I mean, I, I'm similar to you. I advocate for, voices that are not necessarily heard, that are silenced. Yeah. And I guess my passion comes from, my mom being a black, a South African woman, and my dad being a white Portuguese man. Yes, he landed in South Africa through colonialism, but that's another story. Like, similar to Trevor Noah, being born a crime, not being able to, my parents' marriage not being legally recognized when they first got together, all those legacy things that's left behind kind of is that fuel to ensure that you're leaving a positive imprint in the world, right? And so everything that you've just said there just really resonates with me, because this is one of the reasons why it's important to amplify those messages back into the world so people understand apartheid may have ended, but that doesn't mean the suffering and the inequality has stopped, particularly within certain marginalized communities. And South Africa has, like you said, there's a lot of complexities as a result of things that happened from our past. And we cannot – one of the things I heard recently, actually, there was a post on social media about LGBT stuff. And someone said, why are we worried about the UK when it's places in the Arab world and African countries that are worse in the way they treat LGBTQ plus people than we do here in the UK? Which I obviously had to restrain myself from being you know, rude or using swear words. But at the same time, it's like no one's saying one is worse than the other. You know, we have our own issues here. We have our own hate crimes and stuff happening here. You know, yes, we know about the issues in those countries, but there are people advocating continuously to try and stop it, being brave like yourself, you know, being open and out and speaking up about it. So, yeah, those sorts of things always I always find quite upsetting and alarming. Yeah,
and I think it's such an important thing because we cannot ignore that lives matter everywhere and anywhere.
Absolutely.
You know, because for me, it will be such an ignorant part on anybody if you assume that, you know, discrimination stigma doesn't exist in the UK. Yes, it might not be as rapid apparent as in many other countries, but it's there. Mm-hmm. And one cannot take away that. And are we also not trying to calculate or create a kind of an imbalance where we thinking that other lives don't matter, just one life, it's enough, it's more than enough, anywhere, wherever it is. And I don't think it is right to you know, delegitimize struggles of people where they are, you know, because even in the UK, it's not only just the British, you have people who come from any other parts of the world who migrated, who seeked refuge and asylum. You have people who are born in the UK and who are still struggling today. So I think struggles exist, and of course where we need to build solidarity is needed. We always also rely on our British, our American and other parts of the world to build solidarity with us. Absolutely. Like even in the region, you have out of 54 countries in Africa that still criminalize, 30 countries that still criminalize homosexual act in Africa. They rely on countries like South Africa because as much as we know that crimes, hate crimes and victimization persist in our country, but we know very well that people are aware that also protection is in the law. Mm-hmm. It's better, you know, to be protected than not to be protected at all.
Absolutely.
You know, so we need to continuously build solidarity. The situation in Uganda, in Kenya, in Ghana, in Ivory Coast, in Nigeria, the situation in Botswana. Mm. Botswana was one of the recent country that decriminalized following the court judgment, you know, that took place. But I mean, there's also opposition parties who are coming out and said, but you need to reverse this judgment, you know. And I don't think we can expect not to be building solidarity amongst each other. So as you said, even at the beginning, the stronger and, you know, and many of us are there, it's the stronger we are, all of us together.
Absolutely. And calling things out when we see them, because, you know, if we don't, we'll continue in the spiral. And I always think if they take rights away from one person, imagine what they could do to everybody else. That's how I always explain it to people. That's why we should be allies of everyone, everybody who suffers, everybody who is being stripped of rights, because just, you know, you can just have a change of government, change of perspective, and suddenly you end up with, you know, people like the likes of Trump or, you know, far-right governments who have these obscene views and don't necessarily believe in equality for everyone. So in terms of, this has been really a wonderful discussion, honestly, and it's been so eye-opening, even to myself. You know, I try and make sure that I keep abreast with what's going on around the world, but it's always good to kind of hear it firsthand from people who are actually living through the experiences. So in terms of support and allyship from, say, the countries like the UK or from the listeners who will be listening to this podcast, what would you say are quick wins or ways that people can help and get involved with some of the work that you do?
No, look, I think Solidarity is the first one. I mean, it's immediately for me, people speaking out, whether in the corporate world, in the government, or in you know, both private and public space. It's quite important. The second one is, you know, when you have people who are willing to share resourcing, because as I indicated, for activists in Uganda to function, they need resources to move around, to organize, and to speak out, or else, you know, we know lives are at stake, and you have countries with activists who had to move out of their own countries, and they find themselves fighting outside, right? Whereas if it was fighting inside and you were resourced, you know, you would do better. And that's the history of organizing. You cannot organize without resources, which one way or the other.
Yeah.
So, and resources are not always about money. They are also about technical support. They are also about lending a voice, you know, of resourcing. So for me, I think some of the quick wins that we've seen, one cannot walk away from this past 10 years without accepting that we've moved, you know, we've shifted the borders. Mm-hmm. We've shifted, you know, a decriminalization conversation. We've shifted conversation much stricter globally and in countries. If we are to take away that, you know, we would be doing an injustice of the activists that have been organizing. I mean, you look at the situation in Sri Lanka. There's an organization called Equal Grounds. Mm-hmm. You know, Rosanna, who's been working for decades in Sri Lanka. Right now, you know, a country of hers where they would never even print a newspaper talking about LGBTI people. Mm-hmm. Right now, they can do that.
Amazing.
You have countries in Malaysia, you've got a person called Peng, you know, who have taken the government to task in many ways as an artist, as an activist. You know, he's organized in that way.
Yeah.
But even when you bring it here, again in the region, you have SMUG that has Frank Mugisha. I think, I mean, it's quite amazing what they've done in the last 10 years from the introduction of Anti-Homosexuality Act, you know, to being organized and supported. So I think there's baby steps of certain policy aspect. I've spoken about even what HIV response is quite important in sub-Saharan Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Which is predominantly, you know, the highest region with HIV epidemic. What have been happening in sub-Saharan Africa? We looked at the HIV policies where it includes key and vulnerable population. And key and vulnerable population includes LGBTI people. It includes men who have sex with men. It includes transgender individuals and so forth. And they are medically or biologically a vulnerable population, and particularly social and structural drivers drive the HIV epidemic in this region. So if countries have moved to include LGBTI people in those policies and programs,
mm-hmm.
this is a step in the right direction. But also now talking about the environment, talking about you know, the rights, economic rights and so forth. So all these, it's a developmental agenda. So we are trying different approaches to include LGBTI people, and we are moving in the right direction. It's slow pace in other spaces, but it's quite relevant space.
That's amazing. And I mean, some of the people you've mentioned, I know they do a lot of work in solidarity with Kaleidoscope Trust as well. Which we know of here in the UK, and I know we've been doing some fundraising for them recently with the company that I work for. And I know there's a call to action from them. You know, there's lots of, as a result of the pandemic, obviously a lot of countries are tightening their purse straps, and which means there's less support for organizations like the Kaleidoscope. So I know you were saying, you know, sometimes it's not always about money, but it's about people standing up, people amplifying voices, helping and providing, you know, support in terms of platforms. And I think one of the other things I wanted to mention as well, you know, I don't know if in South Africa you have the same thing, but like a lot of people speak out against organizations who kind of, it comes to Pride Month and the rainbows are everywhere and it's all about corporate sponsorship and all of that. But really what we should be doing is holding these people to task and saying, yes, you're putting this rainbows and whatever on your corporate logos and whatever, but what are you actually doing to support initiatives like you said about some of the things that's happening in Africa or in Malaysia or wherever? You know, you want to know, like, for example, Barclays, but all these big banks are very pro doing these sorts of things, but it's like, yeah, what are you doing to actually change the lives of people within the communities where you have these banks and stuff? What are you doing to change the world? And for me, that's something that's really important, is trying to hold these people to task and saying, you know, don't just do this as a tokenism thing. Do it as a, you really are and willing and wanting to change the world.
No, absolutely. I mean, you're quite right, because, you know, this, you know, it's such a difficult time, because even Pride Month, you know, no matter how relevant, you know, the allyship comes in, but we don't want people to only rise during Pride Month.
Exactly.
When, you know, all the other months, people are ignoring the importance of these very same lives.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite important to look at the relevance of why people are speaking out. It's not a pink washing approach. For us, because we do this on a daily basis of standing up, and we want people to stand up everywhere, anytime. So you are quite right, and that these have become political issues globally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even here in South Africa, we've got quite a lot of multiple prides, where, you know, you realize that even pride commemoration or parade themselves, you know, have become so much of big issues here in South Africa. Mm-hmm. We've seen in Cape Town Pride, in the Johannesburg Pride organizing. So for us, I think it's quite important when corporates speak, they don't speak only just during this period. And maybe even corporates must be taken to task. If you are able to take money and create rainbows and, you know, banner your cars, Mercedes Benz and so forth, but you have not taken money to contribute to LGBT organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think you need to question yourself.
Absolutely.
If you can take 200,000, 500,000, a million and do all these colors, take this money and contribute it to an LGBT organization and see what change is really about, you know. And probably that's where you need to pride yourself, to saying we are donating, we are sponsoring, we are contributing, than taking it money and pink wash it again. It means nothing to many of us.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree with that. And hopefully, you know, this message gets out there and it does what I hope it's going to do. And that's to amplify, you know, the voices of queer Black people, particularly within marginalized communities. And most importantly, and close to my heart, is those people of color within Africa. You've highlighted some really interesting topics here, you know, particularly with gender-based violence, which is really, really alarming and scary and sad to hear. But I hope that people that are listening to this, you know, show support, show allyship, show solidarity, and keep amplifying the voices within our community. But I want to thank you for your time today. Yeah. But before I go, I want to end on a sort of more positive and upbeat note. There's a part of my podcast that I do, which is called What's Huggin' and What's Buggin'. Basically, what's hugging is literally, is there anything that makes you feel good, that's like hugging you at the moment, that you kind of wake up in the morning and think, yes?
What's hugging? I think my family does that for me, because I think it's a very supportive structure. My wife and my daughter, you know, I think for me, I look up every morning to waking up in creating a very happy space, and they create a very happy space for me, my extended family, my work environment, my people does that. And all the time, I look forward to really creating a happy moment for the communities. And that's what's hugging for me. And I think it's spaces like this, Josie, that you've created, and that creates so much happiness of amplifying voices, but of also of talking, because sometimes we just never talk. We just work so much that we forget about sharing
stories.
Yeah, whether positive or negative.
Absolutely.
For me, it's refreshing to be in these kind of spaces. So
thank you so much.
To you too.
Thank you so much. I love that. I mean, the whole point of this, my podcast is called Act AOK, which is Acts of Kindness. And I think that's what we need more of in this world. We can always, you know, be horrible and negative and whatever. And my aim and the values that my mom instilled in us was about, you know, showing kindness and not expecting necessarily anything in return. And that's what I'm trying to do, even on a small platform. And is there anything that's bugging you at the moment?
Well, coldness. It's winter.
I mean,
COVID is bugging me.
yeah. I think it's bugging a lot of us around the world. Yeah, we just want to see the end of it. But, you know, fingers crossed for that to end sometime soon.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's important. All of us must be in solidarity and support whichever way. We need to speak about this COVID. We do that on a daily basis here. And we support screening, testing, and also the, you know, messages around vaccination. So we support efforts here locally.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
You know, just whatever. But thank you so much. That was amazing.
Yeah.